Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 945. I am going to be in Denver, Colorado, Downtown Club, Comedy Works, one of my favorite clubs in the country. It's fantastic. And I'll be there with Mike Furman and April Richardson doing shows the April 5th, 6th, and 7th in this year, 2018. A couple of the shows are sold out, so I don't know how many tickets are left. So if you want to go, grab those. Just go to the Comedy Works website. Google it, Comedy Works, Chris Hardwick. It's there. Come see us. April 5, 6, 7. Katie Levine, I feel like there's some sort of corkboard, some sweet corkboard action over there that you might have some info on.
There is. Jason Wood writes, I'm reaching out to your community corkboard because I started my own pin business about a year and a half ago as a side hustle, but it's evolved into a more full-time role in my life. Getting out of the bar business has been a blessing on me and my family. With your guidance and motivation, I've been able to grow my business to heights I didn't think possible. I've been gaining clients by using my contacts from previous work and marketing companies and the brands they support. I'm working on building a website and growing my company. But right now you can find me at 1979 Designs on Instagram. And I take orders from there. And I looked at his pins and they're really great. They're so cool.
That's fantastic.
They're very like kind of retro and cool looking.
Love it.
And then Katie Christ, I think is how you pronounce it, writes, my husband Mark and I have been listening to your podcast for years. Mark has always talked about wanting to be his own boss, and after listening to you push people to make a thing, he took the plunge and officially started a business last fall. His company is called Gunflint Designs. The name is taken from the Gunflint Trail in northern Minnesota. He makes things, mallets, cutting boards, pizza cutters, cigar holders, step stools, pens, cabinets, whatever, out of wood harvested from his grandfather's farm. His work is beautiful, and his YouTube channel is growing. His YouTube channel is Gunflint Designs. His Instagram is at Gunflint_designs, and his website is at gunflintdesigns.com.
Excellent. Thank you, Katie Levine. Do you have anything you want to promote for you personally?
Adopt, don't shop. Adopt animals. Especially like, you know, right now
all
the LA shelters are really full, especially with dogs. If you are looking to adopt or if you want to foster even for a little bit, you know, go to the shelters or the Downey or the Riverside shelter. Those ones are especially high kill, so just adopt an animal.
Excellent.
Don't buy an animal.
You're a very selfless person. I appreciate that. I would have said I have a show coming up or something, but you do it for the animals. I salute you, Katie Levine. This episode is Ed Helms' fourth appearance, we determined.
Yeah, fourth.
We've been doing this podcast a long time. It's not uncommon that, you know, Ed, I guess Ed comes on every 2 years. Ed, old friend of mine, comedy friend, you know, I mean, what? He was in The Office. He was in The Hangover.
He's been
in a million things. And now he's in a dramatic movie that Gaffigan's also in, Chappaquiddick, which is in theaters April 6th. So go see that. Support Ed. Support comedians doing dramas. I mean, there's a lot of other people in the movie too, but you know, I'm just focused on Ed right now because he's the guest. So this is Ed Helms, the ID10T podcast number 945. Katie, please roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
This is your third time on the podcast, third or fourth? Maybe third. Might be third.
This is a triple.
This is a three for
me? I think it's the third to my recollection.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think the first time was maybe right around. Are you still doing bluegrass situation?
Yeah, but in different forms. This is the time where I should have known better than to come on. It's like you do it once. It's like what is this saying? The once bitten twice. No,
no,
fool me once,
fool me twice. Fuck me,
Yes, and now here I am again.
And now you're here one more time. And this time, though, you're not going to be allowed to leave. I don't know.
Never learn.
Nope. This is four.
This is four. Okay.
We were both wrong. So the first time must have been around Bluegrass Situation, which was several years ago.
2011.
That was right around Bluegrass Situation time at Largo. It was at Largo at the time.
Yeah. When does this air?
Thursday. This goes up soon.
Oh, great.
Because Chappaquiddick's coming out.
Yeah, that's right.
The movie you're
coming
in.
Out. But also, since you brought up Bluegrass Situation, so the Bluegrass Situation is like an online hub of bluegrass community, roots music in general.
Yep.
And now we're more just in the mode of kind of like producing shows around town. The festival thing was really tough because there are 100 million. I think at last count there were 100 million music festivals.
About 100 million
in the Los Angeles area.
LA is a tough market to do anything.
But actually, this Friday is a tribute to Jerry Garcia at the theater at the Ace Hotel.
Oh, wow.
It's a Bluegrass Situation event.
So it is bluegrass versions of Jerry Garcia songs.
Not so much. I mean, but like, the Bluegrass Situation is a despite the name, has kind of a broader oeuvre than just bluegrass. So it's people in the roots community. The Watkins will be there and many others.
You've just made me think that I want to pull up one of my favorite covers of all time. Is a Grateful Dead bluegrass cover, which, hang on, here we go.
That you did?
No, I did not. Where'd it go? Rice, Hilleman, and Peterson.
Oh, of course, yeah. Herb Peterson and, that's...
I mean, Grateful Dead songs kind of lend themselves...
A lot of them do. A lot of them were traditional old tunes.
Do you know this cover?
I don't know this one, but I know these guys, and that's an awesome... I like it. I like what I'm hearing.
I just might get some sleep tonight.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think one of the first times we had talked about bluegrass is I had mentioned all these songs that would sound great as bluegrass covers, and you were like, well, that's sort of a... Like a trope, in a way.
Subgenre.
Yes.
That is
definitely bluegrass, but maybe not necessarily like to the purest, like true bluegrass.
Well, it's funny. It's the kind of thing where everyone, I think, who does it's like a cappella covers of things. Like everyone who does it, it's a guilty pleasure.
Right.
It's like everyone scoffs at it, but they love it anyway.
Right.
And I, even as a bluegrass musician, like I love playing. I mean, we did the Celine Dion song together.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was one of the most fun things
from
ever.
Titanic.
Yeah.
And
so it's always like, God, that'd be cool I'm sure I got a recording of that somewhere. that was epic.
If you have that, I'll tack it on to the end of this podcast.
Okay.
If you have it somewhere, that was a really fun fun show. But you know, like Chris Thiele and Gnome do amazing covers of.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of what they're really smart about is they'll do like they do Radiohead
or the Strokes.
Like, yeah, they'll do sort of songs that aren't kitschy.
Right.
Like the kitschy ones are like hair metal songs,
right.
like what we did,
right.
and like, and just sort of, but it also depends on the execution. Like the Punch Brothers, Chris and Noam and all those guys, they're at such a virtuoso level that they're doing a kind of like incredibly artistic interpretation of a song.
Undoubtedly.
As opposed to just kind of like, you know, listen to this Def Leppard tune with a banjo.
Right.
And which is a little bit of a different thought, a different approach. And I don't know. It, like I said, there, it's all it's easy to scoff at, but it's always fun.
I mean, and Nickel Creek does a great, they did a Spit on a Stranger Pavement cover, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, I think the reason that bluegrass lends itself to covers is because a good bluegrass cover, I feel like, reveals the true musical quality of any song in any genre.
Mm-hmm.
Because it, you know, again, when you think about where bluegrass started and how it started, it's like, you know, we need to have the most basic
rudimentary
tones on every level. It's like we need a high tone, we need a low bass tone, we need a... And so it just breaks everything down to a very rudimentary level. And is very
also these
orchestral
are,
in a way.
And these are simple instruments. The original...
It's redneck chamber music is what it is. It is redneck chamber music. Hillbilly chamber music.
Folk musicians were not necessarily known for accumulating mass amounts of wealth. So these
except
were...
Except for a little man named Jed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Poor Mountaineer. I don't know if you knew. He barely kept his family fed.
Yeah. Black gold. Texas tea, as a matter of fact.
Well, let's move to Beverly Hills.
But... yeah, so you're right. I remember trying to describe it to my cousin one time who was just learning an instrument, and I was like, and he was sending me a recording. What do you think of this? And I was like, well, you know, it'll be so great when you add a guitar and a bass. I think he was playing a mandolin, and he was asking, well, what do those different instruments add? What's the deal? And you're right. It's like the guitar is the thick chord.
Mm-hmm.
The guitar sort of provides that thick, like all the tones of the chord. The bass gives you the kind of like just the drive and that very simple tonal kind of precision. And then you have the fiddle or the mandolin kind of doing a more ornate, just lyrical, simple straight line. And mandolins also chord sometimes, or sometimes the fiddle's chopping chords, but you're right. It's the most rudimentary elements, and then a banjo is just annoying ornamentation. And I say that as
the banjo player. But then, you know, when you get a good two or three part harmony in there, then that's a whole other section that rounds it all out.
Then you're getting high lonesome.
Yes.
And then you're in a whole other area.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's. Yeah, the harmonies in bluegrass are insane.
I do have that on my presets on Sirius XM. I have the Bluegrass Junction.
Bluegrass Junction. All right, there it is.
Mm-hmm. You know,
toot toot.
And there are some, you know, fantastic old recordings. We probably talked about this the last time, but there was a syndicated radio show maybe in the 40s, I think, in California called the Maddox Brothers and Rose. And it was just fantastic. And they would like, you know, it was very folksy, but, you know, there was the relationship was like, oh, they're all these siblings and they're just hanging out and having a good old time.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, what are you guys up to? And they would break into a song, and it's just phenomenal. Like the old radio versions of bluegrass are also phenomenal because the recording quality adds a whole other incredible layer on top of it.
Yeah, it's just like of this anytime you hear that crackle. Of like old vinyl or an old radio recording, it's just like someone poured authenticity syrup all over it.
Well, yeah, because now obviously we can hear so much in digital musical information.
Uh-huh.
But when you think about like, okay, if they're recording a song and they don't have stereo,
uh-huh.
how like what instrumentation and how is that being layered to create a full sound? Through a very shitty recording device, mm-hmm. so that it sounds, you know, like you get the full experience. So you need kind of tinny sounds. You need something super high. You need something super low. And
you're right.
A driving middle piece. So that and you need the voices. Like they had to create the separation.
They got
to
cut through.
Now we can do that digitally, but they had to create the separation.
Well, yeah, and if you watch like some of the old radio shows, there were also TV shows, or there are. The old country TV shows where the choreography of the musicians, because they played around one microphone,
right.
So you'd have like five or six musicians around one microphone, and they knew exactly how to position themselves and to sort of move in or lean out depending on which instrument had a solo, which instrument needed to be featured at a section of a song, or which vocals needed to be featured. Two people might lean in from the side. A guitar leans in for his little fill line. And the more rehearsed a band was, the more seamless it all looked. And it's just this kind of organism. It's like this beautiful, elegant, and ultimately very pleasing sound.
They didn't have GarageBand.
They had to be GarageBand. They had to be that.
Yeah, they were GarageBand. All they had were garages.
That's it. They were in a garage. Yeah. They were in a carriage hut.
Yeah. And they had to. But it's a, you know, it, I mean, you sort of, and you sort of see a version of that when they do Oh Brother We're Out There, where they're singing the, you know, I'm a Man of Constant Sorrow.
Yeah,
you sort
yeah.
of see yes. you see that play out a little bit. But for people who say, you know what, damn it, I'm inspired by this. It is time for me to start looking into this bluegrass thing. What are some good entry points for people that you recommend for bluegrass?
Well, I think if you really want the kind of like old time experience, I would say look no further than Jimmy Martin and Bill Monroe, Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatts. Those are sort of the names that I think speak to old time. Del McCurry. Then if you're really into much more contemporary players, gosh, I mean, there are so many.
Where would you put Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys? Is that more rockabilly?
Yeah, maybe.
It's a little precursor to rockabilly because it was a little bit older than that.
Yeah.
But it definitely kind of has that little bit of a vibe.
Yeah. Were they
electric instruments?
Did they play, were they out of Austin?
I don't know.
Yeah. There's
somewhere in Texas, or at least the Playboys were, according to the title of the band.
Who knows? There was a Playboy mansion in Texas, evidently.
It was a much different Playboy mansion. Much different.
I don't know. There's just just Google bluegrass. Go to the bluegrass situation. Start clicking around.
For Christ's sake, the answer was right there the whole time.
There are artists of the month every month, and they're phenomenal.
How often do you make time to practice?
That's an awesome question, and I go in spurts. Like there'll be 3 weeks where I'm practicing maybe 2 hours a day, and then there will be 3-4 months. 6 months where I'm just
kind of
just kind of picking up a guitar every now and then and plucking around, but I really I tend to practice for things as opposed to like general maintenance practice, which is not good. Like I should be practicing all the time and I should be improving all the time, because the other exciting thing, Chris Hardwick, is that the educational opportunities available online now for learning instruments, they're insane.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, they're like, I use this app called TuneFox.
Okay.
That has like it's tablature, it's notation, and it plays the tunes for you. And you can watch as a banjo player. You typically don't read music; you read tablature, which is kind of a visual representation of where your fingers go. And it's like music, but it's a little different. And this app, like, it just makes it so easy, and you can learn stuff so fast, so much more quickly. It has built-in metronome, all these learning aids. It's so fun again. Like, practice was such a drag when I was a kid, trying to, like, I can't learn this thing. I don't know how to practice. I don't know how to, like, you know, your teacher gives you exercises, but they're just miserable. And then now – I don't know. It's like a joy. There's online lessons. Artistworks.com has great lessons.
Have you ever thought about doing like a masterclass banjo thing?
I feel like that would be sort of like maybe a high level intermediate class, not quite a master class.
Okay. All right.
No, I haven't thought about that. Well,
there's an online service called Masterclass.
Oh, of course.
And weirdly, they just started sponsoring the podcast, but I was a fan of it before. But like Steve Martin has a comedy.
Oh, of course, he has his comedy class.
Yeah, and there's
like, he should be doing a banjo class.
He also could do a banjo class.
Yeah.
But he did comedy. Maybe they just feel like there are more people interested in comedy than learning to play the banjo. I don't know.
I respectfully disagree, but.
Sorry, I'm so sorry.
Or may I rude of me. Maybe I should put it this way. What's the difference between
what
comedy
is the
and
difference?
Banjo?
What's the difference? Yeah, I mean, I watched there was a YouTube video of a guy who, you know, it was like a 7 or 10 minute video, but he just posted, hey, this was just me practicing piano every day for 18 months. And he just did a check-in like every few weeks, every month or so. And just in 18 months, which goes by like that. And it's already April of 2018.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Yeah.
And the quality of his performance just from playing like an hour or two a day is insane in just 18 months. And so when you quantify it in that way.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, oh my God, yeah, I guess if I just put a little bit of time. And an instrument is the kind of thing where, I mean, like with comedy, you sort of can see the results after time, but so much of it depends on where you're performing and audiences, and some stuff works and some stuff doesn't. But you can really see a linear improvement curve with just devoting a little bit of time every day to an instrument.
I would say and what's incredible is they say perfect practice makes perfect performance. So, and to me that was so I didn't understand that for so long, practicing in a way that is actually constructive, as opposed to just sitting there and maybe playing stuff you know and playing through just old things that you like or whatever, but actually drilling and learning things. And that's what these apps and stuff are so good at, just showing you, oh, this is how to practice.
Right.
And yeah, an hour, all it takes is an hour a day. It's that's such a exciting example of human potential, I feel like. What we could be capable of if we did anything for an hour a day. And like comedy is weirder and more sort of amorphous of a thing to practice. Yeah. But I do believe that like when I started out doing comedy in New York, I was bad. And I was not funny and it took years before I don't even know if I'm funny yet. I'm still working on it.
Well, you can't do – when you start out, you can't do comedy an hour a day usually.
Yeah.
Maybe you can do a ton of shows in New York and do that. You can write an hour a day.
Yes.
But you don't – but that's just part of the process. You still have to go somewhere and figure out if any of that material works. You can just practice anything in an instrument, any kind of – an hour a day.
Yeah.
And it could literally change your life. And as long as you don't think – I have to be the best person in the world at this. If you just say, I'm just doing it for the process each day, it would blow your mind, even in a month, of how much you improved.
This is why, and learning a language.
Yeah.
Should we make a pact now to learn what?
Si. We should. I'm sorry, that was a little bit of Spanish. We haven't learned it yet.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, see, but these are the kinds of things that
has
you learn.
Begun.
Yeah, I always think about that too because I subscribe to Rosetta Stone.
Me too.
When we
Babbel, I think is the one I use.
Babbel.
Yeah.
When my wife and I went to Japan, I was really fascinated by Japanese as a language because it is very. I think English is a very difficult language to learn because it's so colloquial and it's so regional, and we as Americans just fucking throw out the rules whenever we feel like it. But Japanese is very, it's very standardized in the sense that it all makes sense. It's very mathematical and makes sense.
Hmm.
This is the sentence structure, and this is how it works, and this is, you know, you say this if you're asking a question, and you say that, and, you know, and I was really fascinated with that. So, of course, I come back, I get Rosetta Stone, so I'm really going to learn Japanese, and of course, I never did. I probably should learn Spanish living in Southern California. It would be much more useful to learn Spanish to communicate with people, but I've been stuck on the Japanese.
This is one of many reasons you're a terrible person.
Yes. Believe me, don't think I say that to myself. I just want to say it to myself in multiple languages.
Yes. No, I did this when we went to shoot Hangover 2 in Bangkok. We were going to be in Thailand for 2 months or maybe even a little more, 9 weeks, I think. And I was like, oh, what an exciting opportunity to like immerse myself in another culture and just kind of learn more about it. And I actually hired a Thai language tutor and I started studying Thai language for probably 5-6 months before I went.
Yep.
And it was it's funny because it's an example of like kind of when you try to do something, but you're really just sort of outsourcing it. And which is to say, like, I had this tutor come like twice a week and we would sit for an hour and like talk about Thai language and grammar and even read, you know, symbols, like trying to learn to read it. And then she would leave and I wouldn't think about it until she came back.
Right.
And, And I wasn't really learning anything. I was just paying somebody to make me feel like I was learning something.
Did she communicate only with you in Thai?
No. It was she was stupidly. I should have just said, let's practice some colloquial Thai on a regular basis. But I went in and I was like, I'm going to learn it from the ground up. Teach me the alphabet. Teach me teach me how to pronounce the. All of the symbols, teach me all of it. And that is such a ludicrous undertaking to be like, oh, in 6 months I'll be able to go and hang out.
Sort of like Karate Kid with karate. Like in a month he's going to be a master. Like you can't – we sort of take for granted like, oh, I can probably just learn. But it's sort of like you're binging on it.
Yeah.
And so it's not settling into your your molecules as much.
Except that that's a bad example because he'd won the tournament.
But he did, but he learned, but he basically became a karate master in like 4 weeks.
Yeah, which is what, yeah.
But if you remember Karate Kid 2, it picks up exactly where the first one left off. So he goes to Japan.
Yeah.
And at the very end, spoiler alert, ends up kicking the shit out of a kid who literally is karate. Like, he's devoted his entire existence to karate. And just because they play these little drums.
Yeah, right.
He just swings his arms and just beats the shit out of a kid who was probably kicked his way out of the womb. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So there's no... It's that type of – that's what we want in America is like, you know, 1 week mastery.
And yes, you're right. I know,
like we want the result and not the – by the way, can I just throw you a little
– I feel like you're throwing shade on Karate Kid. And that's,
no, I'm not. I love Karate Kid.
Okay, all right.
To the extent that YouTube Red is doing a new Karate Kid series that is fucking brilliant.
Okay.
Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Okay. So it's Billy Zabka, who played
Lawrence,
and Ralph Macchio as LaRusso. And it's them in life now, and basically because where it picks up is it looks like in the trailer that they've made Lawrence the protagonist because he got his ass kicked by LaRusso.
Yeah,
his life went to shit.
Love
LaRusso
it.
Becomes this very successful car dealership owner, and then the Lawrence guy decides to like pick up the pieces of his life by reopening the Cobra Kai dojo where he starts training nerds who are getting bullied, but maybe with not the best. Skills, like with not the best emotional tool sets.
Okay.
But it's almost, it looks like in the trailer, like it's from Lawrence's point of view. And that seems to me like such a brilliant way
to
pick that story up.
Yeah, he's the untold story. Like we never got the complexity of the bully. We just sort of understood.
He had a bad teacher.
He was a very one-dimensional jerk.
Yes.
And there's more to it. I want to know what it is.
But that's like every kid who bullied you in school, if you went back, they'd be like, oh yeah, you know, my dad used to knock me around. I had a bad home life. And you go, oh my God, I hated you all these years. I didn't know I needed to have empathy for how horrible your life was.
Well, that's a certain percentage of bullies. And then I feel like there's the bullies that are just like, no, I just love beating up people.
I'm bigger than people and it's fun.
Yeah, and my parents loved me and they encouraged me. And my dad high-fived me all the time. And I got a certain drunken pleasure out of exploiting your happiness and sucking the life out of your school days. And breaking your glasses and stomping on them.
The well-adjusted bully.
Yeah.
No, I know this is wrong. It's very edifying to me. And I can do it. And I can get away with it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I was very much my parents.
And might I add, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, nothing really. You know why? Because I'm really good at it.
And I'm going to take you down if you try anything.
It's not really even that hard. It's kind of boring at this point. I need to find new bullying challenges, if you will.
Yeah.
But with the language stuff, it takes practice, and I think you need to be fully immersed. When I took my my college language was Italian, and from day one they only spoke to us in Italian, because there's a difference when you're young, you associate words with things, but when you're older, you tend to associate a foreign word to a word you already know, and then to the thing. So there's a two-step process.
Right, right.
So I think you're not internalizing it as much because, you know, like if I look at this bottle here, I would say, ah, bottega is a bottle, which is this thing.
Right.
As opposed to just looking at that thing going, ah, bottega.
Yeah.
So do you know, and did you retain any of the Thai language?
Literally, I only remember sawatikap, which is like hello. That's about it.
So,
well, the other thing is, when we got to Thailand, this was another really sort of naive or sort of foolish thing on my part. Our work schedule on those movies was so intense. It was like 12, 13-hour days. You wake up, you go, and you're just grinding all day, and you come back and you go to sleep. And there's no – and we're on a set with – we're not interacting with Thai people.
Right.
And we're not having like – and, you know, like on the weekend, you're pretty much just trying to catch up on sleep.
Right.
And so it was not – It wasn't
a vacation.
It wasn't – well, it just wasn't a cultural experience per se. I mean, it was exciting. I love being in Bangkok. It's such a crazy, cool city. And just living there, kind of going out to dinner, walking around, exploring, all that stuff is wonderful. But I didn't have – it wasn't – yeah, I just didn't have the kind of like interaction with local people that I sort of – fantasized about
right
ahead of time,
because you're working the entire time.
We're working.
It's not a
vacation.
It's sort of like when you think, oh, I'm doing stand-up this weekend, I'm going to the city, I'm gonna go to the museums and go around. And you go totally. You're like, I'm exhausted, I have to rest so I can go perform. So you end up not really doing the things you want to do.
And this hotel with tinted windows is so much more pleasing than any museum could possibly be in my tired state.
Yes, of course I would, in theory, love to see the ghost town copper mining culture that used to be here. Wow, what a fun experience to widen my horizons. However, I have to do two shows tonight, and I don't get to sleep during the day at home. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm just going to do that here instead.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'll go to the Applebee's and the Cracker Barrel, and not just because it's easy and quick.
Yep.
Are you touring a lot now at all?
I haven't done that kind of thing in quite a while. Are you on the road a lot?
I go on as much as I can.
Yeah.
But I do understand.
Are you cultivating material all the time? Are mm-hmm. you're always writing?
Yeah.
Are you going to steal stuff from this podcast? Are you like, how does it work?
You know, I would love to steal stuff from all the podcasts. And the unfortunate problem is I forget everything I say the second the podcast. These podcasts are so much in the moment and short-term memory.
Yeah.
That I, you know, people will say to me like, oh, that... if they speak to me in vague terms and said, oh, that was a really funny thing you said on that one podcast, and I'll go, I don't know what you mean. And then they'll say it, and I'll go, did I say that? Like, I have no recollection.
That's
of...
like the people reference specifics from Office episodes.
Oh, I can imagine.
And, you know, we did hundreds, and I and it was, you know, I think for people who experience the show in these half-hour chunks, it's so different than from our side of it, which was like one episode was 5 days – five like 12-hour days just grinding to get – and that's up against every other episode that's five 12-hour days
right.
in a row. And it does kind of mash up together. I'll watch episodes of The Office and be like, oh my God, that's hilarious. I know, like, that is – was I even there mentally? Because I'm standing there in the scene. But
you're also – like, I would imagine if you're, you know, like being super riffy on the show and – you don't – in your mind, you may not necessarily be selecting the piece that's going to get – you're just like, you know, you do your lines, you riff a bunch, you fuck around, and you move on to the next thing. And then it's someone else's job to lift out the pieces that make this – oh, this is the, this part of this. And you, oh, wow, did I say that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I didn't even
remember. I don't even remember that.
Totally.
But was the show – I must have asked you this at one time, and I'm sure you've answered this a lot. How improvised was the show, and how – I'm sure you had like a basic spine of a story to stick to, and then there was probably some fucking around that.
It totally depended on the it almost was like what's happening in a scene, and is that scene conducive to improv? Because a lot of times – there was a lot that was not improvised. I mean there were – everyone was very good at it when it and there were certain times where it felt natural or it felt like a good place to kind of riff, and certain people riffed more than others naturally, but the writing was so good that it wasn't as much improv as you might think.
Got it.
It wasn't even anything like, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, which isn't even scripted.
Right.
That's just outlined. So The Office was scripted very meticulously and so brilliantly. The writers were so good. It was not very often that you felt like you needed to improvise to enhance something.
Right.
But you might want to improvise to sort of try other things. I also think the Talking Heads, that's where I improvised the most, mm-hmm. because that was like my character's voice. More specifically, like speaking for himself.
Wait, you were in the band The Talking Heads? Is that what you're saying? You're in the band?
Yeah. Wait, what? Did I?
Huh? You said, was it? What?
But those moments were, and it seems like it's great to have that process where everything, the foundation of everything is so strong. So if you're just adding stuff on top of that, if it works, great. If not, then the source material is already solid.
Exactly. You get what's on the page, and you know you're good, and then maybe you have some fun on top of it.
And then is that show coming back? Did I read that's coming back, or that was a rumor that The Office was coming back?
I don't know what that is.
There was like a minute where I thought, oh, you know, on the heels of like Will and Grace coming back, oh, now The Office is going to come. But then I never heard about it again. Yeah. So I don't know if that's a
Roseanne.
Thing. Roseanne came back.
Mm-hmm.
I read a whole article today about how it just seemed funny to me that they said, here's how we can deal with Roseanne season 9. Like, we need to, you know, because it's a sitcom. But I guess season 9 just got batshit crazy of Roseanne. At the beginning of the season, the Connors won the lottery. Or Dan had a heart attack, and then he recovered, and then they won the lottery. And then Dan was cheating on Roseanne, and he went away, and then came back. And then all this batshit crazy stuff happened. And at the very end of the series, it turned out they justified it by undoing the entire season, where the end of the series is Roseanne basically like writing about her memoirs. And it turns out Dan actually did die. And that was just a fantasy of like what their lives would have been. And so it's like, okay, so if the show is back now, you kind of just need to pretend it's picking up from season 8 and not from season 9.
I never watched that show that much. That was one of the shows that I sort of caught now and then and chuckled at, but I was not a diehard fan. Were you?
I did watch a lot of it. It was pretty revolutionary in terms of the voice of the show. Uh-huh. It was sort of the 80s, 90s version of what Norman Lear shows had done in the 70s, which was just sort of a very kind of real talk
mm-hmm.
kind of a sitcom as opposed to, I mean, it was very jokey.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was so driven by her point of view and the amazing actors that around it that it, and it was just sort of very like, oh, this is a slice of life of a very specific family, and it's not a cookie cutter sitcom.
Right.
Some sort of they deal with real issues. Some of the episodes are a little dramatic, and you know, I thought it was a great show.
Have you? And it hasn't started yet, right?
No, I think it's about to.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So while we're learning our new languages,
yes.
we'll get together for Roseanne nights.
And
you and I.
Or Rosé and Roseanne. we'll have Roseanne nights.
Roseanne. So Chappaquiddick is coming out April 6th. And they just sent me the link to it last night, so I haven't seen it yet. And
what?
I know, I'm sorry.
Pause. Hit pause.
Wait a minute.
Watch it.
And come back.
And come back. And we're back.
That was great.
Thank you.
Oh, my God. The level of detail.
Yes.
Yeah. So Chappaquiddick, it's kind of – I think about these types of stories sometimes. Like, what would have happened if that had gone down in a social media era?
Mm-hmm.
Like, would
– I think we're watching that, right? I mean, it feels like the whole country right now is just a bonfire of the vanities playing out. It's –
way beyond what we ever could have imagined.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know that. There's something kind of quaint almost about that story now because, like you said, it isn't. Things just catch fire now in such a crazy way that story, which actually played out in kind of a slow plodding way, this feels so antiquated.
And that was definitely a period of time where they could control
a little more, yeah,
the media a little bit more and what got out, and you know, local authorities.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that they had more or less power to control the media. It's just different tools, different kinds of. I mean, it seems like with the dissemination of false news, mm-hmm. that that's just a different tool to accomplish the same thing.
Oh, I guess that's true.
And kind of like trading on or playing to emotions. I mean, I thought that Cambridge Analytica secret, the tape of the CEO talking, yeah, and where he says it's winning elections is not about the truth. It's about emotion.
Right.
That, you know, it's too bad that he's evil because that's such a powerful insight and it's so true.
Right.
And I think if people understood that, that's some that is a piece of knowledge that can be kind of used for good or evil.
Well, I see that working across so many different sectors. You know, my wife and I watch a lot of true crime shows, and I always think about how, you know, especially if you've watched any of the court case dramas, the Dassey one, which I can't remember the name of right now, but or the Jinx or any of these other ones, yeah, and you see like, you know, I think we as just random citizens think like, oh, if you go to court for something, if you're on trial for something, it's really about discovering the truth.
Mm-hmm.
When it's kind of not. Mm-hmm. It's really about winning the case.
Right.
with whatever tool sets either side has. And you would think in so many instances, someone would just be able to stop and go, hey, Your Honor, I'd love to just tell you exactly what did happen,
yeah,
you know, during this questioning. You know,
yeah,
but it seems like, oh, you can't really...
Well, but that, you know, it's so funny you say that because I would watch like old cop shows and stuff or like legal dramas, and you'd see the lawyers try to manipulate a witness, and they would say, ask a question, and the witness would start to give an answer, and then the lawyer would say, nope, stop.
Please answer the question.
Yeah, stick with the question. And then, but I always thought, well, didn't they just swear on the Bible to tell the whole truth and nothing but the whole truth? And can't they make an argument that, no, if I stop there, I haven't told you the whole truth.
Right.
Can't I just – I need to give you context. But the lawyer keeps saying, no, stop. Like,
I only want the truth that I want to get out, yeah, so that I can win my side of the case.
Yeah, but I always thought the witnesses sort of were handed over too much power in those situations. Like you can – like the whole truth is not just like a series of factual – statements. It's also context. That's what the whole truth is. That's why you say whole truth,
right,
instead of just the truth.
Whereas, you know, like if you said something like, oh, that fucking guy, I'm going to kill that guy. And they say, did you say you wanted to kill that guy? Well, yes, I did. Well, that's all we needed. Oh, no, wait. I was at a comedy show. I was, yeah, you know, like, or whatever. You know, like there's no context. And so, you know, maybe I know it's the best system that we have. But it always kind of flips my mind a little bit when I think like, oh yeah, it's not necessarily about getting out the truth. It's about,
yeah,
either side winning that case with whatever the protocols for the justice system that are in place are. And that to me is it's the same kind of thing where,
yeah,
it's like, oh, you think it's about one thing. Really, it's about this other emotional thing,
yeah,
instead.
Did you remember a a movie in the 80s called From the Hip?
Yeah, but I can't remember
Judd
what it
was. Judd Nelson.
And oh, it was, yeah. Well, he was a crazy lawyer or something?
He was like a young lawyer. And,
right.
And he was like a rising star in this law firm, but he's kind of a maverick. And,
right.
And unorthodox, and he gets handed this huge case to defend this this big sort of corporate bad guy. And he's super excited, and he starts to defend him, and he's sort of kicking ass in the court scenes, and it's going great. And then there's this moment where he realizes that his client is 100% guilty of this crime, and he has this this kind of moral crisis. And there's this scene, and I don't know why. I think my dad was a lawyer. Maybe that's why I sort of like that paid so much attention to this movie. But because it's kind of a forgettable comedy.
Right.
But there's this moment where he goes to his boss, like a senior partner at the law firm, and he says, "How is it that what's ethical isn't moral?"
Right.
And I think that is such a powerful question, and it's something that people in power, in the media, in politics, just don't ask themselves enough. Like, what you can, you can sort of like let yourself off the hook because what you're doing is ethical.
Right.
But you don't, and that allows you to just sort of not analyze the morality of it.
Well, and I think that's part of the chasm that's created because, you know, I think we always, we as sort of functioning members of society, I think need to feel like, for the most part, people go, well, as long as I can justify to myself with any molecule of anything,
right,
that I am not a piece of shit.
Yes.
And so it is sort of picking and choosing those things and going, well, I'm following these mm-hmm. rules. Yep. So that's just the system. I don't know what to say. That's just the system.
I'm still a great guy.
Yeah.
And from the hip, it's kind of brilliant. He realizes his client is guilty. And so he kind of throws the case, but in a brilliant way where it looks like he's fighting for his client.
I gotta watch this movie.
I don't know. I mean, it may not hold up. I haven't seen it in 20 years or more, but it is. For some reason that scene always stuck with me.
Well, because it is a very valuable question now, and especially, you know, with the world the way it is, you know, what's ethical, what's moral, is it possible to be both? You know, how do you even define, like, first of all, we have to collectively agree on, I mean, with ethics, there's some type of infrastructure in place that kind of defines those rules, but with morality, that's sort of a loosely agreed upon human idea that there's no, you know, real rule book unless, you know, you look at the Bible or the, right, or whatever sort
there's
of
religious. Lots of rule books.
There are lots of rule
there's
books.
There's thousands of rule books.
There are lots of those rule books. But I mean, but they're not universal, you know,
sure,
like they're not standardized. It's sort of like you have to subscribe to one.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes a question of if I'm being moral, by whose morality am I adhering to? And if I have my own, does that impede on someone else's? I mean, it's so messy, and I think human beings do not like messy answers. We just need A or B.
Yeah.
Okay, A is this, B is this. Okay, good. I don't have time or energy to really go into C through Q.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah. How do we rectify that or justify that?
I think it's a matter of just having a little bit of humility about your point of view, like, and just always kind of asking, am I sure I'm right?
Right.
Am I sure I'm right? And what I kind of envy about Donald Trump in a way is that he doesn't actually – to ask yourself, am I right, is kind of a it complicates things. It makes things a little messy and it makes things uncomfortable
sometimes.
Creates
a lot more work.
Yeah, it creates more work to justify your actions. And
you might have to undo some things.
And it actually creates – it's actually really hard work to sleep at night when you ask yourself these questions. And Donald Trump just doesn't seem to ask himself that ever. And I don't know the guy and personally, but the aggressiveness with which he sort of like – toes the line of his own perfection is I don't know, weirdly enviable to me. I like
what if he's just like at night, just this guy we don't see, he's like, oh my god, everyone hates me. Everyone just hates me. I mean, I think to some degree that may have been poking at him, which is why, you know, he would get so emotional on Twitter because things would get under his skin.
Yeah.
But they were typically like vanity things.
Right.
You know, but
But he can still keep it together in person. Like, he doesn't – like, in those debates, he never choked. Like, usually someone who questions themselves, that's what a choke is.
Can I tell you what, though? It was a classic example of the, like – just to reduce this to like a high school election where it's like you're running for president of the student body,
mm-hmm,
and then you have people who are just like really taking it seriously, and there's one clown who's like, I'm just gonna fuck with the system.
Yep, you're right.
You know, and the kid goes in, he's like, yeah, if I'm president, no homework.
Yeah,
and everyone's like, what?
Totally.
And they're like, but the people who are adhering to what their traditional maybe ethical base
right,
of rules
right,
are
right.
Like, that's not possible. What do you mean no homework? I'm going, well, listen, you want homework. You want these people to work. I'm just saying I wouldn't do it, but whatever. Fuck you guys. And I'm like, this guy's the fucking best. And then that dude ends up getting elected. And then he's like, oh, fuck, I was just fucking around with you guys. Like, I didn't really want this.
Yeah.
Now I got to do this, you know?
Yeah. Then he's held, his feet are held to the fire, and it's like, well, were you serious about no homework? And he's like,
I never said that. No, you did. You definitely, nope, I didn't. All right, well, he says he didn't.
All right, well, I did, then
no,
it
we
is.
We have proof that I don't, no, whatever. No,
yeah.
You're not.
Isn't that funny that people in power being toppled by their own sort of shortcomings is predicated on them acknowledging their shortcomings.
Well,
and if you never acknowledge your shortcomings, you can just stay put like Trump's doing. It's insane.
And I know that there are exceptions where that's not true and the other way does, where people do get toppled. But you're right. And I think part of it is most empathetic people, or most people in general, do kind of prey on regret. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yep.
Have you ever been in a situation where you get in an argument with someone and then you're like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I messed up. And then they get madder. They're like, yeah, you fuck it. What they almost sort of, because it's very empowering to dominate someone in that way.
Yeah.
And if someone can't be dominated, some people just don't know what to do with that. Yeah. They're like, and they go, hey, you did this.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, you need to know you did this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
Yeah.
Well,
you need to make amends.
No,
you need to take responsibility for it.
No, fuck you.
Yes, you do.
Fuck you.
God damn it, you're so
no, fuck you.
Oh, my
no,
God.
Your shirt's ugly.
Why
fuck
are you.
You
not taking
my shirt's ugly. What are you talking about? I don't know what to do.
Exactly.
You know?
It's just a brick wall.
It is. And because there's no transfer of energy there. It's just constantly being reflected. And so people are like, I was not mentally prepared for this. He doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
I can't prey on that in any way because he doesn't. It's just,
I can't find truth. I can't find like an agreed upon set of standards by which to measure ourselves.
And now I would say that's a bad example. But other people were like, no, it doesn't. It just means do whatever you want and you don't have to fuck it. Yeah. You know, like, no, fuck you. And then, you know, the other thing that it creates is that if enough people are on your side, then no matter what happens, they'll, you know, sort of like with Alex Jones or any of the InfoWars, if, you know, if he ever would get in trouble for something, then his people would sort of write the story in their head of like, oh, well, this is just a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, like, because he's the conspiracy guy. And so then your audience is sort of like protecting you because they don't want to violate their own core belief system, because they don't want to say to themselves, is he right? If he's not right, that means I'm not right. Therefore, I must be right. Transitively, he is, of course, right.
Yeah.
And this is how that all ties together. And so,
oh boy.
You know, it's just
There's a very peculiar hiccup in human psychology called the backfire effect, which is when you are presented with information that that totally contradicts what you hold dear, a belief, a core belief of yours. Not only and it doesn't matter how convincing or conclusive this information or evidence is, if it contradicts a core belief or a core value of yours, you will not only not believe it, you will double down even harder on your original position.
Yeah.
And that's why Twitter is such a just nightmare of inefficient bloviating. Like,
of
there's
course.
No there is no way to convince somebody of something that goes against their core values without a much more circuitous and difficult tack.
Well, they have to be willing. They have to be willing to say, am I right? We have to be willing as a people to say, I'm right.
And but what I'm saying is, even somebody with the best intentions, even like an intellectually honest, very sort of humble person, if you challenge something that is core to their identity, they are going to push back. It triggers the same thing that that physical danger triggers, the fight or flight response.
Right.
The same thing happens mentally. And so you have this sort of fight or flight psychological response, which is no.
Because you have to protect your identity as much as you have to protect your physical body.
Yes. And so it's like, exactly right.
If you've ever been in a relationship with someone and then someone comes to you and goes, hey, I have video evidence of the person that you are with cheating or being an asshole, you know, a lot of times people might just go, I don't want to, because they just can't.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. Or like the person in Vegas who they start doubling down on their bets to make back the money they've lost. Like, when points to, like, that doesn't really work, you know, but it is very difficult to deconstruct and reconstruct.
Yeah.
The castle that you've built around your identity.
Exactly. Well, and what you said about your sort of your psychological identity being just as precious to you as your physical personal safety.
Right.
Like that, and that is true. And that's why that fight or flight response isn't just a physiological thing. It's a psychological thing. And until people sort of understand that and ask themselves, like, am I having a backfire effect right now? Is this something that I'm challenging for the wrong reasons, or for reasons that I'm not even aware of? Like, until we have that level of humility on a broad scale,
right?
Then we're just going to get more and more fractured.
That's
and
true.
More and more sort of angry at each other, and I don't like it.
But some of it's on the responsibility of some. I think some of the responsibility is ours when communicating with those people to
absolutely
not come at them, because they're. If you come at them aggressively, they're going to be defensive. But if you really do try to listen and hear people, even if you don't agree with them, and you say to them, like, I hear what you're saying. I really do. Here's why I think, here's where I'm coming from, though, and here's why I think these things. Then in a way, acknowledging that you're listening to them complements their identity. Like, right. it gives a compliment to their identity so that you're accepting it. And then maybe they're a little more open to go, okay, as opposed to just throwing up the shields because you're like, well, fuck you. How could you say that? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Well, then you're not going to get anywhere.
What you're saying is, like, we should be cordial to each other. And I agree.
It doesn't always work.
Like, we should lead with kindness. But
it's hard to sometimes.
It's hard to be kind to jerks and bullies.
People who are
professional bullies.
But when we understand that, you know, unless it's the type of all-star bully who's just really good at it,
yeah.
that we were talking about earlier.
I love that. Yeah. I love that bully who's just so at ease with his bulliness.
Well, it sort of reminds me of the Merv Griffin elevator killer in Man with Two Brains. Do you remember that?
No.
There's a Man with Two Brains. There's an elevator killer in Europe, and Steve Martin gets on an elevator and he sees this girl being murdered and the camera pans up and it's Merv Griffin. And he's like, Merv Griffin, you're the elevator killer? Like, it's been a mystery this entire movie. And he just goes, yeah, you know, I've always loved to kill. I really enjoy it. You know, but I got too famous back in the United States. People were like, who is that lurking over there? Is that Merv Griffin?
Oh, my God.
So I came here. You know, like, he's just so like, yeah, I'm really good at it.
Great.
I don't know what to say.
I love it.
But it is that good. But for most bullies, though, I do think they're hurt. You know, like, mm-hmm. they're damaged and hurt. And so they're extra aggressive and defensive because they're sad or hurt or they lack a certain amount of control in their life, and so this is how they feel like they have that control. And so it's I don't think we should, you know, whatever, some people are just fucking dicks and they need to be stopped, but I do think sometimes if we approach some of these, and not all, but if we approach some of these people with at least the ability to be open to hearing them, that they might open up so that we can kind of get in and help them to undo. With some people, it's just the only communication skills they have. Like, yeah. it's sort of like, you know, if you adopt a pet, that dog might have some baggage that you have to spend a lot of understanding and time and care to undo, because that's the only way they've ever learned how to. They don't even have the skill set to do what you're suggesting.
Right, and people who are damaged in all kinds of different ways project onto the world around them and project onto people around them their own fears and worst expectations of how they're going to be treated. And so when a bully is oftentimes responding to a sort of fictional threat, something that they've projected onto the people around them, and or a fictional shame or a sort of imaginary. And it's not just bullies; it's also people who are who have anger problems or who are just like maybe really petty and annoying at work. Like people like that. Usually, those are symptoms of sort of heartbreaking projections onto the world around them, like
well,
how they see what's happening.
Yeah.
And And I don't know. It's hard to find empathy for people like that.
It's been a trial for me because I was heavily bullied in grade school. And
I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
I did that.
Why would you do that?
I did it.
Why would you chase me with your banjo? Who bullies? You can't. It's like the old Steve Martin bit. You just can't be sad if you're playing the banjo. Oh, death and grief and sorrow and murder. Like he's playing the banjo. Hey, Steve, your house is burning down. Doesn't matter. He's playing the banjo. But I am gratified by justice tales. Of course I am.
Yeah, of course. It feels good.
Where the bully gets taken down. Like, yeah, because that guy thought he could get away with it because he didn't
karate
have any.
Karate Kid.
So good. Yes, right there.
Kicked in the face.
Well, that's one of the jokes in the trailer is that, like, they run into each other at a party and someone's like, oh, Dan LaRusso, hey, didn't you kick this guy's ass back in high school? And Daniel kind of smugly goes, technically it was the face, you know. And then Lawrence is like, yeah, nice to see you, you know. I mean, it is very intoxicating to feel like you can say whatever you want and you don't have any boundaries and you can get away with it, you know. But again, power is a responsibility and it's not one that most people, I think, use wisely, particularly online, where they can be anonymous and they know I can say whatever the fuck I want because I'm going to get away with it.
Yeah,
and it does drive me crazy, but I just have a hope for humanity.
Me too.
That there are nuggets of goodness in all those people, and that with enough, you know, just like it's worth it to adopt a pet and spend the time to give them the tool sets to be friendly, that you know. That maybe we need to do like an adopt a bully program.
Adopt a troll.
It's like a troll adoption every third Sunday at the Gelsons.
Yes.
Like a little troll in a cage, like, fuck you, piece of shit, fuck you. Oh, this one's, yeah, I don't know. We found him on the streets of Pacoima. He was just tweeting
incessantly on his iPhone, sitting on a public, on a
fuck
bus.
You, you're fat and stupid. Yeah. Oh, look at that. Oh, we're gonna do some work with him, though. We're going to do some work with him.
Yeah, we're just going to work it out.
Well, my mom has a bully cat. Like, my mom has the most adorable, fluffy cat who's a fucking bully. This cat, like, my mom is so maternal, gives it nothing but love. It looks like a plush toy, but it bites and scratches her constantly. I'm like, Mom, maybe just leave the back door open. Like, it literally, because I hate to see my mom with scars on her arms. And my mom is like, defends. It's not her fault. She didn't ask to grow up. However, she, like, my
that
mom
is
one of those
sweet.
People who is endlessly optimistic, will put in the time, will put up with all of the bites and scratches. And so, you know, maybe that's what we need to do with our adopt-a-troll pro. It'd be a great sketch, by the way. We need to do an adopt-a-troll sketch.
But that idea that your mom captured, it's not her fault. Like, that's a powerful thing. You know, that's like Goodwill Hunting, the therapy scene, like his troubled childhood, and Robin Williams is like, it's not your fault.
Right.
Like, acknowledging that is, I think, opens the door for empathy.
Slippery slope, though, because a lot of people will use it as a sort of narcissistic way to deflect having response. Well, it's not my fault.
Yeah, it's not at all.
So,
yeah,
some people, it's not their fault, and for other people,
sorry, I'm damaged. Sorry. Sorry I cheated on you and abused you.
I'm just really fucked up.
I'm so damaged and not my fault.
Yeah, maybe in those instances, those people should have the awareness to say, like, hey, I did this, so I'm going to do some work to try to not do this anymore. Maybe that's where the line is, as opposed to just endlessly going, oh, it's not my fault.
But, you know, there is that weird, like, when you – Like that feeling of when Danny LaRusso kicks what's his name?
John Lawrence.
In the face. That feeling, that visceral feeling of payback, of like, I showed him. That is like a troll's fuel.
Yeah, of course.
And how do you neutralize that fuel? Because it's rarely like in the case of the Karate Kid, like, he won and he got a trophy and it was so clear that he was like victorious both morally and ethically and across the board.
Right.
But in the case of a troll, they fire off something in a comment section and it's like, I won that thing, but they didn't.
Right.
And it had no impact. But they still got that feeling. They got that rush.
Well, the bummer thing about trolls is that Yes, there is that very stereotypical idea of like, oh, it's just a sweaty guy in a basement whose life is bullshit. But then you start finding out like some of them are just like, yeah, just dudes with normal lives who it's just – there was a whole storyline on South Park last season about how Kyle's father was trolling people and he was just saying the worst things online. He was like, I'm just doing it for the lulz. Like there are people who like – by every other aspect or not, do not fit into that box. And they're, you know, the problem is humans are just too complex.
Yeah.
You know, like we need A and B solution, A or B solutions for, you know, very complex situations. And maybe that's the same thing with our legal system where it's like, well, it's not perfect, but it works the best of any system that we've tried or in any system that we've had.
Agreed.
So
I mean, it is, it's, we are imperfect. We are messy and complicated, and we have to adhere to systems that do the best.
That's
and
why you need to practice an instrument an hour a day,
uh-huh.
Because that is a very clean thing to mm-hmm. be able to wrap your mind around. If you practice, you will get better.
And you need to go see Chappaquiddick twice a day.
Twice a day.
So that
you'll get so good at seeing that movie.
Can I say something self-serving right now?
Say whatever you want.
So
this is your time.
This is everything we've talked about. We've kind of done a bad job of connecting it to the movie Chappaquiddick. But
do it.
Is,
do it now.
No, but it's like, well, you should have been doing it the whole time because this is all so just roped into the DNA of this movie and who Ted Kennedy is and what the Kennedy family and Camelot and the legacy of the Kennedys and the power and the influence that they had, how they chose to use it, how someone responds to a tragedy in that moment of fight or flight, fear, reflex, like what do I have to lose? Like, how can I get out of this in a way that is ethical, even if it's not moral? How
right.
can I sort of like, how can I cover my fucking ass? I'm scared out of my mind, which
right.
I think is something a lot of people can relate to. But we also chastise other people for it when we see it. Like, how do I, is there moral ambiguity in Ted Kennedy's case, or is it cut and dry? Did he absolutely do everything wrong, or is there any place for like seeing ourselves in him? And I think any honest assessment, there's like he did the wrong thing. There's no question he did the wrong thing. But I think the where it gets like where there's like a sort of challenge to a viewer is like if you can get away with something, would you?
Right.
And or would you try? Would you at least try? And that speaks to the question of like that power and how it's utilized. And there's no question that there's lots of ways that the Kennedys abused their influence in their how much they were adored. There are a lot of ways that they also made the world a better place with their influence. And it's just it's such a soup. It's such a messy, grotesque soup that it is delicious drama.
And after you did this movie, did you have a different point of view on everything by the end of it? Or did you come out of it kind of where you were?
I don't know. I think it reinforced for me just the complexity of our heroes. Like, I grew up in a family that definitely venerated the Kennedy family and thought that and I do think that the sort of public values that the Kennedys espoused are worthy of admiration. Their private actions, as is the case with most people that we put on a pedestal, are kind of gross and disgusting, or at times overtly criminal mm-hmm. and horrifying. And that's what makes that just speaks to the complexity of our values and how we project them onto our heroes and we sort of don't allow for even after Chappaquiddick, like the Kennedys were staunchly defended and people had their but I don't know. I'm getting sort of like lost in the weeds, but I do think it just reinforced that that we just have to be careful with our with how we perceive our heroes and who we sort of label heroes and who.
And if we're never willing to question,
yeah,
we do like to set things on autopilot so that we don't have to think about them again. Okay, yeah. This is how I feel about that thing. Done.
Right.
Because it takes a lot of work to go back every so often. I mean, I've told this story before, but I remember, I used to be deathly afraid of, like, staying in a hotel on a high floor because I just don't like heights.
Hmm.
And so I would always avoid it. And then one time I got booked on a high floor in New York, and it was the only floor available, and I was terrified. And I'm like, oh, my God, I don't want to – I kind of went through the breathing. And then for a second, I had to stop and go, do I still actually feel this way? And when I really kind of dove deep, even on this very superficial thing that's not, what you were talking about, but I realized, like, I don't think I actually feel this way anymore, but I never would have known that if I hadn't asked myself and kind of dug in and done the work.
Right.
So I have said to people, like, every once in a while, it's good to check in to make sure you actually even still think the things that you think you think.
Uh-huh.
Because you might have just set those on autopilot, and those autopilot decisions kind of have their own little, automated robots that defend those positions.
Yes.
But maybe you don't necessarily think the things that you still think.
That's...
And that can also be a relationship to a bully. Oh, God, I don't know if I'm – and if you can let that stuff go or change how you feel, it is very – it does lighten your spirit in a way.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. Am I still angry at this bully, or are these just reflexes?
Right.
Am I still sort of tortured by these memories, or are these just reflexes?
Do I still like this thing? Do I still like this person? Am I still afraid of that? Like, it is good every once in a while to check in and make sure, because you evolve and grow as the nature of having experiences.
Yeah. I mean, that's an example where sort of the passage of time kind of alters something subconsciously.
Sure.
I think in the case of Chappaquiddick, I mean, obviously it was something that happened a long time ago, but even as it was unfolding, or even sort of through the lens of it, of like, how would I look at this if it was happening right now, if I knew all of this information, it's something that I feel like it's just about recognizing that it's never as simple as it looks. It's almost never.
Nothing is.
It's just never. And people aren't as evil or as good as we think they are.
Right.
It's a great villain written in, like, a great villain character in a movie, you have empathy for that villain.
Because
they've been humanized in some way. And I think that, I'm proud of the movie because I think it's sort of an unflinching portrayal of some pretty, like, horrific activity, and I hope that it just challenges everyone to be like, what is, like, where do I stand on, like, when people that I might admire or people that I think are great are also doing bad things? Can I accept that whole person? And it's the same thing if you're like a Bill Clinton fanatic and like some of the things that he mishandled, like some criminal justice issues that he was like just awful about, or of course Monica Lewinsky, which is just like, these are things that if you're a Clinton supporter, can you just admit that those are bad,
right?
And be like, but that's the whole person, and I can still support that person. And if you're a Trump supporter, be like, okay, I love the values that he's sort of like saying, but lots of his behavior is reprehensible. and I'm willing to support him because I think that his policies are based on his sort of point of view, on what he's saying, even though like the way he's behaving may be something that's off-putting to me. But can you just say that? Can you like accept the entirety of somebody?
Well, and again, and even, relatedly, sort of the idea of, if you're friends with a bully, mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, he's really mean to people. He just likes to have a good time. It's like, like the idea of what people what people even think of as acceptable or reprehensible or whatever. They might go, it doesn't, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
My friend has three boys that are like 6 and under, and the middle one is just a fucking cool kid. Like he's definitely going to be the lead singer of a rock band or something, but his parents don't put him in leather jackets, but he likes to wear like cool like rock clothes. Mm-hmm. He's like 4. And he was telling me, his dad was telling me that they were at the park and some kid was like, "I don't like you." And he goes, "Oh, what did you say to the kid?" And he just goes, "Yeah, I just told him that was fine. You know, whatever. You know, like, I think he really, you know, he probably really does like me. I don't know, whatever. I don't care." And I was like, I can't imagine being that well adjusted.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I would have unhinged me.
Does he meditate, this child?
Yeah.
Is that
he's very much into breathing exercises and awareness.
He's just super in touch with himself.
Yeah, but it's just points of view and like what you're willing to accept and how you perceive things. And unfortunately, even for you to say like, well, can people admit that some person's behavior is reprehensible? They might go, well, no, it's not. It's like, that's necessary because that's how that keeps the, or, you know, like, like Monica Lewinsky. Well, you know, he's the president. He's under a lot of stress, you know, like, you know, or whatever. It's just like, it's easy to make, and also, you know, if you've ever been in a very toxic relationship or if you've been in a relationship that at a certain point you kind of after a couple years go, well, how did this get here? How are we here? Well, something strange happens. You make an allowance and then you make another allowance and you make another allowance.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden all the allowances just become the new norm. But it was so transitional and incremental.
Yes.
That you didn't even notice it was happening. And now here you are.
Right.
And how do you justify that and how do you get out of that, because that is now part of your that is bled its way, seeped into your core belief system. So how do you change that? It's the same kind of situation.
Yeah. And it's that impulse we have to just paint a really like with a big paint roller one color on something and just be like, it is this one thing,
because that's easier.
And it's a real is, but then If you really want to be honest, you really want to be sort of like an honest participant in the world and observer of the world, you have to take a magnifying glass to that paint stripe and see all the different pigments and imperfections and all
that. You know, it's all short-term versus long-term arguments, where most things that are easy in the short term become difficult in the long term.
Hmm.
So if it's easy to just like paint everything one, that's just easy now.
Yes.
Well, later on,
yes, you're right.
You're going to have to deal with it. Where it's like, you know, the same thing of like, I don't need to hire a plumber. I'll just fix this. It'll be easier now. And then, you know, 3 times the amount you would have paid later because you fucked everything up in the moment. You know, it's like convenience, emotional convenience too.
Yeah.
Can be the enemy of long-term
for sure
of long-term happiness or long-term fruitfulness or health, long-term health,
self-love and edification.
It's easier to have this drink now, it's easier to do this now, it's easier to make this allowance now, it's easier to not,
it's just repress this,
it's easier to not spend an hour a day learning a new thing because it's hard, but you know, but over time those little it's easier for now choices can add up to a, well, now there is a fucking pile of shit that I have to scoop out of.
Oh, boy.
So,
yeah.
But
that's a great that's clearly what Teddy and his little cohort were doing in the Chappaquiddick incident, was sort of like, this is easy. This is the easy decision right now. Like, I can try to sort of like punt the responsibility in this little way and then shift this aside and move this. And then 10 hours later, it's like the enormity of it,
right.
Like the scale of this, like tragedy starts to soak in, and it's some bad decisions.
Well, I'm also very excited for you for being in a big time fancy drama movie.
Thank you.
Which, you know, I mean, it can be a very challenging thing for people who do a lot of comedy to, I tend to think funny people make amazing dramatic actors because, you know, with comedy is a certain amount of damage, and with damage is a certain amount of depth.
Mm-hmm.
And if comedy people can access that, I don't know if you think of yourself as a comedy person, but I think a lot of people would think, oh, Ed does a lot of comedy.
He's done a lot of big box comedy. That's all I cared about for most of my career. And yeah, all of a sudden now I'm kind of like, well, how do I mix it up a little bit? And I'll be honest, I I tried to make Chappaquiddick funny. I riffed, I improvised, and they didn't use any of it.
There's a whole other movie that didn't get, you know, that's out there that if they had cut it differently.
But no, it's been a really fun challenge. I don't know, just another challenge because some of my favorite actors have gone that sort of comedy to dramatic arc. And I, for a long time, I never even saw the appeal. I remember telling my agents early on, like, I just want to do like the movies I saw, the Chris Farley movies.
You want to do David the From Spade. The Hip reboot.
Yeah. all the big summer comedies that I grew up loving, the Austin Powers and all that stuff. That's all I wanted to do for so long. But now for some reason, I hate this word, but maybe there's some like maturity kicking in.
Maybe.
And I'm like starting to hit mid 40s and I don't laugh as easily at the same dumb things. Like I still think farts are funny, but yeah, I don't think they're as funny as I did maybe like 10 years ago.
Well, that's a problem. They're still really funny.
They're super funny.
Maybe you should talk to a therapist or something because that doesn't even make sense.
That's a flaw.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's just been a really fun journey. And what was really cool on this movie is that one of my co-stars is Jim Gaffigan, mm-hmm. who is, as you know, one of the greatest stand-ups of all time.
Yeah.
And someone who I knew when I first started doing stand-up in New York in the 90s, Jim was like a little more established than me and was always so cool and nice to me and someone I looked up to. And to work in a dramatic context with Jim and for both of us to be kind of like stretching our legs this way. I don't know. It was a really fun, it was a really cool opportunity.
Well, that's fantastic. And I have a link to the movie now, so I'm very excited to see it.
I hope you like it.
Should I just give you $20? Like, cause I feel like my wife and I, cause we're going to watch it without paying for it. We could just each give you $20 as a ticket's $20, right?
Yeah. I'll take $20.
Great. So $40. Yeah. For if Katie's going to stick around, you got to kick in $20 and,
yes,
and we'll just give you, we'll just go direct to artist.
I'll make sure it goes to the movie studio
and the
distributor and all that. Yeah. I'll divvy it up.
You're going to end up being in debt to them somehow. Hey, I got this $60. Oh, okay. Well, since you got that, we're actually way in the red. You actually owe us $100,000.
Oh geez, okay.
Fuck. Oh boy, really studio math. I don't know what to. But so I would say people should see Chappaquiddick. They should see you and Gaffigan in April 6th, and then also practice a thing once a day. And you know what? It doesn't, whether it's a language or an instrument, or I'm going to even go as far to say is even 5 minutes a day practice empathy or positivity or appreciation.
Yes.
Or asking yourself, am I right about things?
Do
Just practice that and just see what happens to your life, even in just like a month or 6 weeks.
Amen.
And then, and if nothing happens, then
come back and talk to Chris and me, and we'll work it out.
Yeah. We'll sit down with you and find out what really happened.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, Ed
Thanks
Helms.
For having me.
Good to see you again.
Always
for the
a pleasure.
Fourth appearance on the podcast. As always, enjoy your burrito.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Girls Fight Back is the world-renowned personal safety and empowerment-based self-defense company that teaches women and people of all gender identities how to live confidently while being their own best protector. As a leading voice on violence prevention and empowerment for over 20 years, Girls Fight Back has trained over 1 million people around the world since 2001.
Their engaging workshops create a safe environment for groups to learn evidence-backed, life-saving skills, emphasizing that self-defense education is about more than just physical resistance. Girls Fight Back, led by CEO Nicole Snell, provides audiences with a range of applicable safety strategies that can be used in any setting so that you can lead a badass life.
To learn more about Girls Fight Back and to bring their award-winning trainings and seminars to your community, visit girlsfightback.com. That's girlsfightback.com.